All right, hi everyone, and welcome to session two of the Fantasy Summer School. We have two wonderful speakers for this session, and we are starting with Professor Giuseppe Pezzini, who is tutor and fellow at Corpus Christi College, Oxford. And he is a classicist by discipline. He's also the Tolkien editor for the Journal of Inkling Studies and one of the founders of the Oxford Tolkien Network. He is the author of many publications on Tolkien, including a monograph on Tolkien's literary theory, which is out now with Cambridge University Press. And I'm also delighted to say, this is allowed to say it now, he is the consultant for the new Hunt for Gollum film, which will be released with Warner Brothers in December of 2027. So he is the official consultant on that. So if you want to ask him about that later, I'm sure he'd be happy to take questions. So without further ado, please welcome Professor Pezzini.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Grace. Thank you very much, Stuart and Caroline, for inviting me today. Thanks for being here. As Grace was saying, I'm a classicist, and today I will have the pleasure, in a way, to connect my two main life interests, the classics and Tolkien. I hope you got a copy of the handout, all of you. I will refer to it quite often. And so what I'm going to do now is to discuss the classical reception in Tolkien. And they said this is a bit of a case study for classics in classical reception in fantasy, although at the same time I must say that Tolkien's case is a bit idiosyncratic, okay? So I wouldn't say that what I'm going to say today is can it be applied to all fantasy authors, but maybe there will be some ideas, some hints that will lead also to a better understanding of classical reception in other authors. In some sense, classical reception in Tolkien is a bit of a new subject. As you may know, for many years and decades, it was more the Nordic ingredient in Tolkien's soup that was more considered. But as you can see on the handout number one, in the past few years, there's been a bit of a surge of interest in classical reception in Tolkien. And in a way, what I'm going to say today is a bit of a contribution to it. And to say that Tolkien was a classicist, in many ways, is very accurate. As you can see, from the handout, Tolkien was a student in this university, and the first subject that he studied was classics. But several years before that, at the age of 10 or 11, or maybe earlier than that, he had started to study Latin with his mom. In a way, Tolkien at the beginning was homeschooled for financial reasons, not for ideological reasons. And then one of the subjects he studied with his mother was Latin. Then, in 1900, he moved to King Edward School in Birmingham, which was one of the most top grammar schools in the country at that time. King Edward, his training in Latin and Greek started really to flourish. In this school, students were trained to not just to read literary text, but also were expected to converse and to compose original Greek and Latin. And we know that that's something that Tolkien excelled at. And we have also some record of Tolkien's own engagement with this sort of exercises, debating in Latin, performing plays in Greek. So it's not a surprise, therefore, that he decided to apply to study classics in Oxford. And he applied at the beginning to my college, which is Corpus Christi College, but then he was rejected, he failed the examination. And in a way, for the people who know Tolkien's life, it was that failure that led his sort of adopted father word, Francis Morgan, to say it, from now on, you're not going to think about your girlfriend, but you will have to study hard to get into Oxford. So in a way, we are somehow responsible for the kind of bit of a drama, in a way. And it's a bit of a nice paradox and nemesis that after many decades, Corpus Christi College will hire a classicist who was also a Tolkien scholar in many ways. As you know, after 2 years of his degree, Tolkien decided to change and went to study, changed on the other side and went to study English language and literature, and yet Tolkien never rejected his classical training. His work, especially the early work, I will say, is filled with classical resonances, often a knowledge, Tolkien himself acknowledged an extensive use of classical reception. So, for instance, you can see on the handout, has he explicitly referred to classical epic to describe some elements of his secondary world, including, for instance, the heroic horseman of the Second Age, who lived in a heroic state, and I quote from letter 131. Influences of classical heroic epic have been identified also in the Catabasis journey in Moria, the Paths of Death, the escape from the fall of Gondolin, that's even clearer, I think. But also there are several topoi and scenes, including especially one which is the catalogue of warriors. You remember Minas Tirith, and we know that in the manuscript Tolkien made a note saying Homeric catalogue, okay? So he clearly had an Homeric catalogue in mind. But again, you see there are a few examples on the handout, but the list is growing. I mean, I would say especially the Fall of Gondolin, which I recently read, it's impossible not to see the influence of the Book II of the Aeneid, for instance, in the Fall of Gondolin. But that would be for another lecture, maybe. So what I'm going to do now is to focus on one particular case where I think we can see the influence of classical motifs. And using it, I will also try to expand a bit on what I think was Tolkien's mode of classical reception. And this motif, number two on the handout, is the motif of the narrative of decline. A narrative of decline is essentially a narrative, a story that posits a gradual degradation, moral and ontological, but also spiritual and technological, maybe, of humans or nature, or the two together, from an idealized past, a golden age. Again, I want to go into politics, but you see how the word golden age is still, the phrase golden age is still used very, very often nowadays to justify maybe problematic things. But anyway, that's a narrative of decline that has an archetype in Western literature, which is a poem called The Works and Days by the Greek poet Hesiod. You see number two on the handout, I quoted especially a passage which is really like the archetype of any decline narrative going back to a golden age. This narrative was then is also found in Homer in a way, so to a certain extent it predates Hesiod. It goes into the Latin literature. You find it in Catullus, you find it in Virgil, you find it everywhere in a way. Anyone who has studied a bit the classical world will see how the narrative of decline, that things are going bad, it's really everywhere. There are some exceptions like Augustus, the first emperor, who said that the Golden Age was coming back to all, but overall, I will say that the ancient sensitivity was declinist. Life, history is a decline. An important text for this codification of the narrative of decline into the Western tradition is Augustine's De Civitate Dei. You see it's at the end of page one on the handout. Again, I won't go into it today, but certainly, especially in the Middle Ages, the idea that the pagan world was going into a decline was somehow mediated by this important text. If you turn the page, just I want to say a couple of things more about this narrative of decline in the ancient world, which, as I said, is omnipresent, but it's found also in different variants. There is one important variant, which is the one on number three on the handout, which is we may call primitivistic. It's a primitivistic version of decline. Again, that's the one which we find especially in Hesiod, but also in Catullus. And the whole idea is that everything from the very beginning, so the idea that the Golden Age people were living in a sort of a technological world. So the Golden Age was an age with no technology, with no seafaring, with no agriculture. It was a sort of age where the relationship between humans and nature was somehow immediate. That's a very influential narrative of decline, but it's not the only one. We have at least another version, very important and very influential for Tolkien, which is the one number four on the handout, where you do have a decline, especially a moral and spiritual decline, but this does not go hand in hand with a technological decline. In fact, the paradox is that in the Golden Age, the technology was actually more sophisticated in a later age. And that's the version we find in a very influential myth, which is the myth of the fall of Atlantis, which we can read nowadays, especially in Plato's Timaeus and in the Critias, a lost but yet fascinating dialogue. Although in this myth, the description of the Atlantis follows the pattern of a natural paradise, Atlantis is a natural paradise, its inhabitants were not kind of primitive beings. They engaged in agriculture, they engaged in mine work, in workmanship, and in fact they were to a certain extent artists and builders. And that, therefore there was a society in Atlantis which was golden, but also was a society very rich. It's not the kind of pastoral, bucolic version that you still, instead you find in Hesiod. And so two versions of decline. I introduced them both because I will come back to this when I talk about Tolkien, okay? Because Tolkien is able to take different ingredients, again, even from the ancient soup, and reforge them into a different kind of artifact. There is one important implication of this decline narrative, number 5 on the handout, which is found in both the versions. Both the versions, both the primitivist and the non-primitivist, have something in common, which is the idea of a correlation between between decline and the gap between the human and the divine. If you see on the handout number 5, the golden men of the Hesiodic tradition lived like gods. They were loved by the blessed gods. Whereas in contrast, when they become the Iron Man, the men of the Iron Age, they have no longer an interaction with divine beings. So there is really a kind of a spiritual decline. That's also very clear in the myth of Atlantis. The early men of Atlantis had participated in a quote, in a portion of divinity, whereas this portion of divinity, the portion of the divine, became faint and weak, and I quote, through being oftentimes blended with a large measure of mortality. So the ancient men were somehow immortal, they were almost semi-gods, and this is an idea which is found quite often in the Greek tradition. And this also explains why the main reason for the decline and eventual collapse of civilization is first of all moral, spiritual, and therefore also political. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I mean, these two versions of the decline, primitivist and non-primitivist, with the common thread of a spiritual decline, are quite often intermingled in the tradition. Okay, so even in the myth of Atlantis itself, we have, in a way, two different versions in the same text, because in contrast with Atlantis, we have the case of Athens, which eventually proves to be the society, the civilization that is better, morally better, which instead is more of a primitivist nature. So in the ancient world, the decline in one aspect of nature or human life can be complemented by a progress in another aspect. So you can decline spiritually and morally, but you can progress technologically. Okay, so it's all a bit complex and complicated. And I could also refer to Epicurean philosophy, where you have really like a combination of the two decline narratives. And this also leads to another very important idea of the ancient world, which, if you think about Tolkien, is also very prominent in Tolkien, which is the idea of a cyclical framework. So life and history in general, it's like a cycle. You start with a progress and a decline, and it's a never-ending cycle from which we cannot escape. Again, this, for the people interested in comparative mythology, we find that this idea of a cycle of ages everywhere in the Eastern tradition as well. And it's quite possible that the Greeks even imported it from the East at the very beginning. But even in this cyclical story, the trajectory is quite similar. The trajectory is decline. I do believe that there is a generally declinist outlook in ancient culture, from philosophy down to popular wisdom, which did feed Tolkien's imagination in his early years. And one of the things I did when I came to Oslo a few years ago, it was to go to the Bodleian Library and check the syllabus that Tolkien studied for exams in 1913, 14 actually. And in fact, Hesiod was there, Catullus was there, Virgil was there. All the texts that are imbued with this narrative of decline were present in the text that knew Tolkien very, very, very well. And in a way, It's interesting that Tolkien took his mock exam in 1914, just the years before the beginning of the First World War. So it is as if his imagination, his literary imagination, was immediately then embodied and refilled by the real imagination, the real experience that he had in the trenches of the First World War. And it is not therefore not surprising, and now I'm moving to number six on the handout, that narratives of decline are really omnipresent and wide-ranging in Tolkien's works. If you think about The Lord of the Rings, we have many allusions to the superiority of past generation and culture. You find them, some of them on number six on the handout. And these are really very similar to the one you find in Homer or Virgil. Just quote one, for instance, from the very beginning of the prologue of The Lord of the Rings. The hobbits have dwindled, they say, and in ancient days they were taller. So the hobbits were taller, now were shorter, and all the creatures and peoples of Middle-earth clearly were taller and bigger in the ancient world. These declinist allusions, as I may call them, resonate also with the landscape, which, as you know well, is filled with ruins or ancestral buildings. You can remember the Tower of Orthanc, the statues of the Argonauts, and all these can be considered as, if you want, vestiges of a lost civilization, I quote, a long vanished kingdom. There is this idea that the great kingdom has now all vanished. Also, just as in Hesiod, humans, men in The Lord of the Rings, fall ill and die much more easily than their ancestors, who, the Numenoreans, live much longer and really led lives a bit more similar like the Hesiodic men of the Golden Age, and I quote again from number six, men who did not suffer miserable age, and when they died it was as though they were overcome with sleep. If you remember that at the end of The Lord of the Rings, Aragorn dies the old way, if you want, by bringing back not just the ancient kingdom, but also bringing back the ancient lifespan of the Numenoreans. Also, artifacts and artworks in The Lord of the Rings that are produced by the present generations cannot really equal with the works of ancient masters. I mean, let me just read a couple of passages. This is what the dwarf Gloin says. In metalwork, we cannot rival our fathers, many of whose secrets are lost. Or again, referring to now in the case of lore from page A60, all lore was in these latter days fallen from its fullness of old. That's a comment on the lore that is now in the houses of healing. If you read the Lord of the Rings with this kind of question in mind, trying to see the traces of a declinist narrative, it's really everywhere, almost in every chapter, and you will somehow find a reference to this inevitable decline of mankind and history in general. Language itself, maybe that's even more interesting. Language itself, the language spoken at the time of The Lord of the Rings, is just a corrupted shadow of an ancestral perfection. And I quote for one of my favorite passages in the whole Tolkien, which is the Bilbo's encounter with the dragon, and I quote, there are no words left to express his stagnant, since men changed the language that they learned of elves in the days when all the world was wonderful. You see, so the language of men nowadays is not able to describe the fullness of reality. Ancient elves could, but not men. So we may even say that Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings is set in a sort of fictional late antiquity. If you're familiar with late antiquity, from the 3rd to the 5th century AD, and read the text dated to the age, you really find a lot of allusion to this kind of perception of decline. Everything in The Lord of the Rings is dominated by a sense that things are not going well, a sense of loss and decline from all points of view, history, language, literature, art, and so on. And go even deeper into Tolkien's sensitivity, it's therefore not surprising that Tolkien himself said that, and I quote from the bottom number six, I quote from letter 96, which I hope to didn't put on the handout, but it's a quote from letter 96. Tolkien said that the heart-wrecking sense of the vanished past was the emotion which moved him supremely and found small difficulty in evoking. So Tolkien was, as himself said, was especially able to express this sense of the vanished past. So it seems like as the narrative of the decline of ancient origin is really at the core of Tolkien's literary sensitivity. Moving to number seven on the handout, Tolkien's Return of the Page, page 3, we can see the Tolkien's declinism, narrative of decline, is evident also the macro-historical level, which we find especially described in the Silmarillion. For the people who read the Silmarillion, you will remember that there is the idea that the history of Arda is divided into a series of ages, the Age of the Sun, the First Age, the Second Age, the Third Age, and now the Fourth Age. And it's every time in the Silmarillion is said that each age is somehow inferior to the previous one in some respect. In each one also, just like in ancient narratives, an age gradually degenerates to moral corruption, a less and less degree of divine interaction, and also finally a catastrophic event, the destruction of Numenor, the destruction of the ring at the end of the Third Age. Another key notion within Tolkien's declinism, which again it's somehow classical, but not just classical, is the idea of the fall, second passage in number 7 on the handout. The idea that decline is also correlated with the idea of a moral fall is of course itself also classical, but for Christians like Tolkien was also tied to the doctrine, the biblical doctrine of the original sins and the exile from Eden. And Tolkien in fact in the letters quite often refer also to the notion of Eden, of a lost Eden. You see here how the classical and the biblical tradition are kind of mixed together, because Tolkien was imbued with both since a very young age. In a way, the fall that Tolkien describes is somehow biblical to a certain extent, but also is classical. I do think that in many senses the classical ingredient is also important to reconstruct the soup of the fall, if you want, in Tolkien. To give just one example, and I'm referring to the fourth passage, number 7, on the handout, in the story of Turin Turambar, if you remember from the Silmarillion. I hope you know the story of Turin Turambar, most of you. I guess most of you are familiar with it. So if you're familiar with the story, it's quite clear how you have a long series of different influences. There is the idea of an incest, which is quite typical of the ancient world, and it's found, for instance, in the story of Oedipus. You remember, in many ways, Turin is an Oedipus, but it's also, of course, Nordic, and there is one particular case of the character of Sigurd that is really, really similar. In many ways, Turin is also a new Sigurd, but also is a new Kullervo. So you have got Kullervo is maybe the main source, if you want, but it's not just Kullervo. You really see a lot of different influences that are like intermingled together into a single character. And there is one case in particular, one narrative of a fall, of course, of a decline, but where the classical component is very explicit. And that's the one you find number 8 on the handout, that is to say, the fall of Numenor. The fall of Numenor was, by Tolkien, explicitly and emphatically connected to Plato's stories of Atlantis. We know the very name itself evokes the myth of Atlantis. In the letters, Tolkien refers quite often to the Numenor Atlantis myth. And in fact, in a very early version of this myth, of this story, the connection was very, very extreme, in the sense that the first version of the story, Tolkien imagined that some time travelers will go back to the island of Atlantis and witness the fall of Atlantis, write down a record that will then complement what Plato didn't write in his own narrative. So at the beginning it was not just a version of the story, it was exactly the same story, just simply retold through a different focalizer, that is to say Tolkien himself. In a later version of the myth, which is the one that we read now in the 1977 Silmarillion, the connection is not so explicit. That's not the island of Numenor, that's not the island of Atlantis, it's the island of Numenor. And yet, the narrative parallelism remains striking, with similarities in the island's divine origin, the landscape, the topography, the idea of a moral corruption, the nature of a catastrophe that befell the island, and so on. And it is therefore not surprising that Tolkien decided to keep eventually the allusive name Atalante for Numenor. And what I find even more amusing is that Tolkien even gave an etymology, saying, and I quote from number 8 on the handout, "It is a curious chance that the stem talat, using quenya in Elvish for slipping, sliding, falling down, for decline, of which Atalanti is a normally in quenya noun formation, should so much resemble Atlantis." So I really love this passage because really Tolkien is claiming that the connection between the Numenon island of Atlantis and the island of Atlantis is just a curious chance, okay? Mm. It's not just something that he wanted, I mean, it's just a curious etymological connection. But in fact, the very etymology of the word, Atalante, confirms how the tale of Numenor is prototypical of Tolkien's omnipresent declinism, but also, we'll say, of its hidden classical ancestry. And yet, what I find interesting, and this is leading to the second and final part of my talk, is that Tolkien still claimed that it was just a chance. Okay, that's something that he didn't really want it. Why is that? I mean, what's the point of making this claim? And that's, I will try to answer this question in the final 10, 15 minutes. And also thereby say something more comprehensive about what we could call Tolkien's idea of classical reception. What is Tolkien's idea of classical reception? And I think that everything can be referred back to this claim that it was just a curious etymological chance. But let me move now to number 9 on the handout and just say a few more, something more about exactly how Tolkien conceived his own version of the tale of Atlantis. As I said before, that at the very beginning, Tolkien really thought of the tale as the tale told by a time traveler. And let me just read the quote from letter 257. "I began an abortive book of time travel, of which the end was to be the presence of my hero in the drawing of Atlantis." So that's really the very beginning. For the people who are aware of it, there was this kind of conversation with C.S. Lewis, and he said, okay, you're going to write a space travel, which there will become Perelandra and the other books, and then I will write a time travel. And the time travel was exactly this, his own version of the drawing of Atlantis. But even at this early stage, if you read the drafts of this early stage, it's quite clear how Tolkien was not just rewriting the Platonic myth. So it was not an adaptation, you see, and it's not like Tolkien is adapting, rewriting or adapting the myth of Atlantis. Rather, he felt the need to integrate this myth in his own authorial mediation. So he was putting himself into the narrative somehow. So it's not just enough to say, okay, I'm now in the 20th century giving a new version of the myth of Atlantis. No, I'm bringing myself inside. I'm bringing my own focalizing authorial perspective into the tale, if you want. Also, Tolkien changed the names, changed the details, and inserted clearly his own creative idiosyncrasies and concerns into the story. And in a way, that's kind of represented by the very fact that he decided to focalize, that is to say, to tell the story from the point of view of an English man of the 20th century, if you want. I think that's a nice image to see, to introduce how Tolkien conceived classical reception explicitly. It's quite clear that from the very beginning, therefore, Tolkien felt the literary urgency to create something distinct from its source, which eventually explained why he decided to abandon the story of Atlantis. And I quote again from letter 94, "My effort, after a few promising chapters, ran dry. It was too long a way round to what I really wanted to make." That is to say, not an adaptation of Plato's tale of Atlantis, but rather a new version of the Atlantis legend. So if you want to use a bit of a graph, I mean, if this is the myth of Atlantis, and this is Tolkien, I mean, in the first stage, we got a derivation, direct derivation. So Tolkien is rewriting the Plato's tale of Atlantis. Whereas in this passage just read, the framework is different. There is one event, which is the Atlantis legend, and then there is Plato's version and Tolkien's version. Of course, the two are somehow related, but Tolkien's like going back to the original event. It's not like going through the mediation of the Platonic event. And that's already like a bit of a step from a framework of a classical reception, which instead is very common in this time, which is simply like we kind of adapt the ancient text to a new audience. In the passage I just quote, there is a key adjective, which is new, it's a new version, which I think is at the foundation of Tolkien's literary theory of adaptation. It is quite related, I think, to what Tolkien says again and again in his literary manifesto, which is the essay on fairy stories, where Tolkien says again and again that the whole point of creating art is to do something new. Creative fantasy, and I quote, is mainly trying to do something else, make something new. That's really like the idea of not just of fantasy, but also what is classical reception. Classical reception is still connected with this basic urge of the artist to make something new. Tolkien's urge for literary newness, therefore, explains why he decided against his original intention to integrate the Tale of Numenor in his own legendarium, in his own mythology, in a way, which is a new mythology. It's a mythology which is clearly influenced by Nordic mythology, classical mythology, but it's a new mythology, it's different. And later in his year, if you turn the page number 10 on the handout, he was even bolder in affirming and claiming his authorial freedom and originality in the use of his myth of Atlantis, and I quote, "The legends of Numenor, the Atlantis myth, are, and I highlight, my own use for my own purposes of the Atlantis legend, but not based on special knowledge, but on a special personal concern with this tradition." So you see, and the question, let me read also the second quote, I think I have time for it, which you will see the same kind of emphasis of the ownership to a certain extent, to the special personal concern. "Numenor is my personal alteration of the Atlantis myth and or tradition, and accommodation, a keyword, accommodation of it to my general mythology. Of all the mythical or archetypical images, this is the one most deeply seated in my imagination." You really see how kind of graph we were saying before. Tolkien is not interested in Plato, but he's interested in the archetype, and he's going directly to the archetype. Not also how in the passages I've just read, Tolkien stresses the personalism. It's a personal thing, the personal entity of his literature. And this kind of emphasis on the personal, or in other letters we see the emphasis on the individual, the peculiar, the particular, the special, and there are other keywords of the kind, are very important elements in Tolkien's literary theory, which applies to both the production of his text but also to the reception, and quote from number 11 on the handout, and another passage from On Fairy Stories, which I think is very beautiful and very relevant to what I'm trying to say. "Literature," and a quote, "works from mind to mind and is thus more progenitive. It is at once more universal and more potently particular. If he speaks of bread or wine or stone or tree, it appeals to the whole of these things, to their ideas, to the event, to the original archetype. Yet," and that's really the paradox, "each hearer," so the recipient, "will give them to them a peculiar personal embodiment in his imagination." Beautiful passage that really says how this, the importance of the newness and the individuality and the personal, not only applies when a new writer produces a new text, but also when we go and read The Lord of the Rings each single time. So every other a literary event at the level of the production and of the reception is always new and individual. At the same time, and that's also something that Tolkien says in the passage I just read, this personal element of literature, it's my own, for my own use, it's a special personal use, so it's a personal thing, yet it's just one of two poles. We have another pole, no less important, which is what Tolkien refers to as the universal or traditional. You got the peculiar, the individual, you got a version of the tale of Atlantis, which is Tolkien's own embodiment, appropriation, but then you got the universal, or in Tolkienian terms, the pattern or the motive. This contrast, this tension, almost dramatic tension of polarities, the personal and the universal, is of course something that the literary authors and literary critics have been talked about many, many times, and at this time, in his time, there was especially a great poet, a literary critic, T.S. Eliot, wrote a very influential text which is called Tradition and the Individual Talent on this very topic somehow. But it's quite clear how Tolkien is giving, in a way, his own version, his own particular, individual, and yet also universal version. And there is especially an image which I put your number 11 on the end of the final passage, second passage, which I think helps to disentangle what was Tolkien's understanding of the polarities between the two different ideas, the individual and the universal. And the quote from number 11, who can design a new leaf? Art wants to do something new. Who can design a new leaf? The patterns from bud to unfolding and the colors from spring to autumn were all discovered by men long ago. Again, I don't want to discuss what he's referring to, but it's really referring to a debate going on at that time. So that is, which is basically, everything has already been said. So every new literary author cannot but repeat what was already said in the ancient world. That's something that even ancient poets like Terence said at the very beginning of his poem. Nullum quam dictum dictum spriu. Everything has already been said. But, Tolkien says, that is not true. Spring, of course, is not really less beautiful because we've seen or heard of other like events. Like events, so like similar events, never from world's beginning to the world's end the same event. It's an event, it's a word I really like. It's an event similar to all the other events, but it's a new event. Each leaf of oak or ash and thorn is a unique embodiment of the pattern. And for some, this very year may be the embodiment, the first ever seen and recognized. The oaks have put forth leaves for countless generations of man. So you see, it's a literary event which is always new at all stages. It's also the time of the recipient. When we look at the leaf, it will be always something different. So if we kind of decode the analogy, we can say that according to Tolkien, every new personal literary event, that is to say, the tale of Numenor, but also every new experiential event, Tolkien's dream of Atlantis, for instance, or Tolkien's experience in the world, is a unique embodiment of an archetypical motive. The decline, things always collapse. The decline and a fall of human affairs, as Tolkien said in the letter I was referring to. Each embodiment, each leaf, is related to all its previous and future embodiments. The Atalante is linked, of course, to Plato's myth of Atlantis. And how they relate, not by direct influence, but rather by, we may say, transitive property. That is to say, both the Atlantis myth and Tolkien's myth are different attempts to tell the same event, to refer to the same event, the same pattern of the leaf. And yet, the terms of this relationship, that's also quite interesting in theoretical terms as regards to classical reception, so the relationship between these two cannot be easily explained in genealogical terms, neither for, that's what we do nowadays in our work, with a simple frame of intertextuality. For the people who don't know what intertextuality is, I am myself an intertextual critic. Sometimes this is not really good enough to explain how texts relate to each other. Not even Quellenforschung, that is to say, source criticism, trying to find for the source, really completely answers to this influence. In a way, the influence remains unknown. In any way, there is an important implication that I will discuss in the final 5 minutes. I will ask you to jump a bit to number 12 on the handout, which is the fact that Tolkien somehow prefers to be a bit agnostic about this relation. Tolkien says, I know that many people will spend many decades after my death to try to reconstruct the sources of my work, which is what we do, which is what I've been doing in a way for the whole time today, and yet that was not enough. In a way, Tolkien's true attitude in front of this strange connection between different texts was the one that he was referring to by saying that the etymological connection between Atalanti and Numenor was just a curious chance. So you see, that is a curious chance. There is an element which is a bit mysterious, which cannot be fully controlled. Probably, if you want to use psychoanalytical term, maybe other more related to something which goes deeper in the mind and the heart of human beings, with the archetypical experience of human beings. So to sum up, Tolkien considers his own literary endeavor as consisting in producing a new personalized version of an archetypical theme or motive. This can also involve the alteration or accommodation of an earlier text, that is to say, a pattern of reception. And yet, rather than a source in a traditional sense, this is construed by Tolkien as just another earlier version of the same universal transcultural archetype. It is at this inner, deep level of literature and human experience that Tolkien suggests the real influence is found. Just like in the life of a tree, a new leaf is more influenced by its underlying pattern rather than by a leaf from a previous year. How this relationship works at this latter, more superficial level is often unclear and ultimately is less uninteresting, at least according to Tolkien. And this is also why, in contrast, and I quote, it is the particular use, and I quote from number 13, it is the particular use in a particular situation of any motive that is most interesting thing to consider. It is also true in Tolkien's own vision of the classical reception. Thank you very much. Before I leave you, sorry, Grace, just a final thing. So you see that I had actually planned to go forward. I had 4 or 5 points to make, which I cannot make because it's very late and I would like to do a Q&A, but I will leave you to delve into it, which is basically to, I was trying to kind of explain what was exactly Tolkien's particular use of the narrative of the decline. And especially this can be answered, I think, by thinking about how this decline narrative is associated with the Elves. But for it, you see there is a picture of my recent book, so you can read to explore more if you're interested. Thank you.
All right, we have about between 10 and 15 minutes for questions, and I think we will start on this session with one from online, if you have one. Okay, so anyone in the room, would you like to ask Giuseppe a question?
Sorry, I don't mean to hog a discussion, but I'm so thrilled that you're doing this work, and I was so happy to see the book appearing, because, again, scholars often forget that Tolkien started his life as a classicist. So maybe it's in the book, which I haven't read yet, but maybe you could use this time to explain this. Very crudely, I always understood that Lewis, who comes from classical background as well, still saw classical tradition as kind of dominant and higher than the native tradition. Whereas for Tolkien, I think it's the other way around. And in a way, it's a little bit counterintuitive. Can you maybe explain why the native tradition was more important for you? Was it just pure nationalism, or I don't
know? Yes, I must say I'm not too sure that is true, to be honest. Okay, I do agree that there is this sort of idea that Tolkien was more, and in a way his work trajectory led it that way. It is true that at a certain point he moved on from the classics, but the idea that he forgot his classical thing is just a bit of a myth. Okay, to be honest, I don't think it's really true. I mean, there are a couple of passages from the letters, okay, that is extrapolated and then becomes the building of a big idea, but this is not really true. And I can tell you something which I discovered in the Bodleian Library just a couple of months ago, which is a text that he wrote in 1959, okay? That's a text which is called Latin for the Laity, okay? It's a very long text. We're basically talking goes on for a long time saying that Latin is the best language ever invented, is a great language, and then he gives a very interesting history of the Anglo-Saxon people and so on. And one of the things he says there is that actually the whole point for the Anglo-Saxons is that they were Latinized and actually the only people in the history of Western Europe. Again, we may disagree with what he says, but clearly Tolkien was remained a classicist in his art, even if he was a professor of English literature, Anglo-Saxon. But we need to forget that he made that move after 10 years of being a classicist. And my students now here in Oxford, I mean, certainly have a much less knowledge of the ancient world that Tolkien had at the end of Mortz. I mean, they were all classicists. I mean, that generation was all classicist. I think Tolkien, as always, wanted to move on in a way. Tolkien moved on, but the moved on was not like I don't really believe so. I'm very happy to be. I don't really believe that he thought that Anglo-Saxon and Nordic ingredient was more important than others in a way. And even if the Lord of the Rings, something that people have been pointed out again and again nowadays, you have a lot of influence of modern literature. The Hobbits have nothing to do with the classics, have nothing to do with the Nordic saga. The Hobbits are really modern characters coming from the novels of Dickens. and the others. Okay, so Lord of the Rings, and that's something that C.S. Lewis himself noted in his early review, is a book which is able to bring together a lot of different things. You got the Anglo-Saxon, that is to say, the Rohan people, the really Anglo-Saxon people, the old English people, the Nordic people are the Rohan people, but already the Numenorian are not exactly just Anglo-Saxon. It's a bit more complicated than that. And I would say that even for Lewis himself, I mean, I don't think that for Lewis himself, I don't really see this big difference between the two, in a way.
Thinking about it as two different things.
That's
basically,
think,
you know, one is a subset.
I do think we are wrong, and this depends again on many factors. Again, there are a couple of passages in the letters when it seems to suggest that the Nordic Helle was more interested for him in a way. But of course, there is much more in the unpublished letters. There is much more in the corpus. But also, I think that it depends on the history of reception of Tolkien, which is that the only people that for 20, 30, 40 years had the courage to work on Tolkien were medievalists, which is all great, but Tom Shippey and others were all medievalists. So by their own nature, they had in a way to use the kind of perspective. But I think that's just one ingredient in a much more complicated soup.
With what you're talking about with Tolkien's sort of personal versus traditional ideas, do you ever get the sense that he's sort of, some of it is unconscious to him, like it's not that he's choosing the traditions, it's like he seems to feel this sort of compulsion. I read a bit about his like dreams of Atlantis. Is there sort of like a...
Yes, the answer is yes. I think
the word unconscious is one of the most common adjectives in the letters and so on, especially in the passages where he tries to explain his own experience. He really quite often refers to the idea of unconsciousness. In the sense that, again, one could explain in different ways, so I don't think the Tolkien will be ready to use a sort of a psychoanalytical framework to explain that. So, I mean, he does refer in a couple of unpublished letters to Jung, so he was clearly aware with Jung, with the idea of Jungian archetypes and so on. But in the passage of On Fairy Stories, he's very, very adamant that for him, the dreams he's talking about are not exactly the Freudian dreams. There is a difference, he says, between the dreaming of fantasy literature and the dreaming of psychoanalysis, if you want. Again, it would be long to distinguish between the two, but I think like what is certainly a common thread is the idea of unconsciousness, that is to say the idea that the author is not in full control of what he's doing when he's writing. So his rational mind is higher, if you want, higher level of the mind, is not the one that explains most of the thing that goes on at the level of writing. He really says, very often he says, I wrote The Lord of the Rings and then I edited it. And so I was, in a way, the first reader of my own work. Tolkien really frames himself not just a writer but as a reader at a very, very early stage. And this is kind of a combination of the two is also interesting because it allows us to connect someone like Tolkien with even postmodern thinkers, and thinkers like Bakhtin or Barthes, who talked about the idea of the death of the author. In a sense, Tolkien was an author who was not in full possession of his own literary work. And the kind of image that he used to explain that is exactly the image of dreaming, that is to say the image of something which remains unconscious to the higher, if you want, mind. Again, we'd be interested to discuss why in this sense is not Freud, is not the subconscious. I would prefer unconscious rather than subconscious, but that's maybe a bit too complicated.
So speaking of online questions, before I ask read out loud the questions, I have to say to our online audience, we're sorry for not being able to provide a handout at this moment. We got many emails, but we do have actually one question is very easy, and it's basically, what was the name of the 1959 Tolkien text you referred to? And the other one is a more fleshed out question, and it refers to narrative of decline. So our viewer asks whether it is related to the physical embodiment of decline, or can it also mean an imaginary decline the narrative can have? So thank you.
Yes, on the first question, the text is called The Latin for the Laity. Still unpublished. As you know, there are plenty of unpublished material in the Tolkien archive, which is great because it means that we've been busy for a few other decades. So it will come out. There is a new one coming out very soon, in fact, in the next couple of weeks, which is called The Bovadium Fragments, which is a sort of satirical piece on traffic in Oxford. So very, very relevant, I would say, to the current discussions. as per the people who live in Oxford, they will understand. On the second question instead is on the physical of imaginative decline. Again, we should discuss what exactly imaginative decline means, but certainly decline is first of all physical. Yes, there is something about physical decline. And for someone like Tolkien, who experienced the Second World War, First World War and the Second World War, and so his own physical decline from a very early age, I mean, something that we sometimes we forget, but Tolkien was in a way wounded in the First World War, and he came back, he was very ill for many months, he had to stay at the hospital, and he kept for all his life a very, very ill, a very, very weak health. We know that he got ill again and again, but also clearly was wounded psychologically. I mean, the kind of traumas that he suffered in the First World War were there, and there was a strain of depression in Tolkien's mind, which clearly can be somehow traced back to the traumas that he had to face in his early life. But in kind of in more thinking more imaginative terms, I mean, Tolkien says in a letter that any story of Made My Men must be about the fall. So certainly Tolkien thought that this kind of idea of a fall, of a decline, is somehow present in any possible story that human minds can produce. Why is that? Again, physical decline is certainly one thing, but I think Tolkien will say that there is something even deeper, which relates to what Tolkien calls the sense of nostalgia for a lost Eden, okay? For something that in a way, and again, this could be explained in religious terms, the doctrine of the original sin and so on, but maybe even more generally in psychological terms, this idea that who we are now and it's not exactly how we were supposed to be, this perception that we are made for greater things, that the things that were there somehow in the past, I think that's a kind of a general experience that the human imagination, Tolkien will say, managed to express from the very beginning.
Thank you. I'll try to keep this very quick. Just I'm noting, looking ahead to the answers you wanted to talk more about, and just thinking about the narrative of decline specifically, and what a powerful thing it is in regard to how we think about ourselves and our culture. And of course, Tolkien is aware of this. And we've heard earlier about how Tolkien was very resistant to having Lord of the Rings specifically associated with Wagner. And I'm wondering about sort of how this, you used the word primitivism and this sense of sort of like, well, if it was older and simpler, it was better. How Tolkien might have wanted us to understand Lord of the Rings in regard to the sort of perils of how that traditional sensibility went.
Yep.
Thank you. I mean, that's a big question. Again, I will try to make it very short, but if you think about the characters in The Lord of the Rings, I ask a question for yourself. Who do you think are the characters in The Lord of the Rings that are most declinist, or in a way that are more prone to think in life in terms of decline? The elves, yes, agree with that, the elves. If you think about the elves, and talking, the elves are all about obsessed with their memory, they don't want to move on, they have the little places, the little kingdoms, Lorien and Rivendell, when time doesn't flow away, doesn't pass away. The elves, that's something that Tolkien explicitly says in the letters, are the best embodiment of this sense of nostalgia for a vanished past. And the elves are obsessed with it, Tolkien will say, to the point, and that's something that he explicitly says, to the point of becoming embalmers. They are embalmers, so the elves are embalming. So you see, if there is decline, then what we are supposed to do? And of course, our temptation is to be a conservative. Again, I don't want to go into politics now, but conservative in a general sense. So things are going bad. So what are we supposed to do to keep things as they are? And that's really what the elves are doing, if you think about it. And that's very problematic. And there is one moment in the Lord of the Rings where this sort of clash of perspectives really come to flesh, if you want, which is in the dialogue between Galadriel and Frodo, because Frodo is there, and he says to Galadriel, take the ring. For Galadriel, to keep the ring will be to keep things exactly as they are, at least in appearance. And she says, no, and I passed the test, but I know that by passing the test, I allow Lorien to be destroyed. Lorien is destroyed at the end of The Lord of the Rings. The past will go away, the elves will leave Middle-earth, because that's basically what the history of Arda wants. But if you think about it, I mean, the gold, Lorien is the golden age wood, is the golden wood. But the gold of the Lorien does not completely disappear. What happens to the gold? It goes to the Shire. And in fact, the following year, we got all the new little hobbits with blonde hair, okay? And it's clear there is a connection there. So there is the gold that has moved from the Lorien. And that's the kind of Tolkien's perspective, which is, it is a long, quite a long answer, but which is like you take a narrative of the climb, which is something that says something about who we are, but not everything. So every single experience of mankind, bad or good, eventually is sort of integrated into a larger whole. Every single leaf, if you want, becomes then part of a tree. So you do have the narrative of the Klein, you do have the elves, and Tolkien loved the elves, but the elves are not the kind of the best people to look at, okay? Even the elves themselves need somehow to grow up and need to accept that the perception of history is not complete.
Well, thank you. We have to end this talk now, but please a round of applause for Giuseppe Pizzini. Thank you.